Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
In 1937, Harry Anslinger co-authored an article entitled Marijuana, Assassin of Youth, which was published in the American Magazine. Anslinger was the first commissioner of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, and the article was the impetus for the Marijuana Tax Act, which was passed later that year. The act made hemp and marijuana illegal in the U.S., and Anslinger testified before the Senate Ways and Means Committee stating to Congress that marijuana incites the user to crime. In the article, Anslinger wrote,
"Not long ago, the body of a young girl lay crushed on the sidewalk after a plunge from a Chicago apartment window. Everyone called it suicide, but actually it was murder. The killer was a narcotic known to America as marijuana and to history as hashish. Used in the form of cigarettes, it is comparatively new to the United States and as dangerous as a coiled rattlesnake. How many murders, suicides, and maniacal deeds it causes each year, especially among the young, can only be conjectured. In numerous communities, it thrives almost unmolested, largely because of official ignorance of its effects. Marijuana is the unknown quantity among narcotics. No one knows when he smokes it whether he'll become a philosopher, a joyous reveler, a mad insensate, or a murderer. It gives few warnings of what it intends to do to the human brain. Last year, a young marijuana addict was hanged in Baltimore for criminal assault on a 10-year-old girl. In Chicago, two marijuana-smoking boys murdered a policeman. In Florida, police found a youth staggering about in a human slaughterhouse. With an axe, he had killed his father, mother, two brothers, and a sister. He had no recollection of having committed this multiple crime. Ordinarily a sane, rather quiet young man, he had become crazed from smoking marijuana. It is the useless destruction of the youth which is so heartbreaking to all of us who labor in the field of narcotics suppression."
Anslinger ran a campaign against marijuana on radio and at major forums.
"By the tons it is coming into this country, the deadly, dreadful poison that racks and tears not only the body, but the very heart and soul of every human being who once becomes a slave to it in any of its cruel and devastating forms. Marijuana is a shortcut to the insane asylum. Smoke marijuana cigarettes for a month and what was once your brain will be nothing but a storehouse of horrid specters. Hashish makes a murderer who kills for the love of killing out of the mildest mannered man who ever laughed at the idea that any habit could ever get him."
Anslinger's sensational article was not alone. The Time was filled with anti-marijuana hysteria. In 1936, the propaganda film Reefer Madness was released. The plot about teens who smoke marijuana and then commit a series of crimes, including murder and rape. In 1937, another movie was produced, Assassin of Youth, inspired by the article by Anslinger, parroting the incredible threat that marijuana posed for, especially, young people.
Don't worry, Beeford! Judge Herbert! What is the meaning of this interruption?
Judge Herbert, I have here the first copy off the press of the newspaper for which I work as a reporter. It concerns everyone in this room. Marijuana, the assassin of youth, the scourge of our country, is reaching out like a mad killer, mowing down the youth of our land, distorting their minds and leading them into lives of degradation and crime. This evil has struck here, Your Honor, right in your own homes, and has turned innocent play into tragic orgies. Why, at this very moment, your courtroom is filled with smokers of this terrible weed. How dare anyone accuse Joan Berry? She was helping me to uncover the source of this living death in your town. Why, in this very case, it was used as the companion of certain people to ruin the characters, yes, even the lives of others, in order that they might satisfy their greed for money. I refer to one of the litigants in this case, Linda Clayton.
That's a lie.
I suppose it's also a lie that you taught a sweet little girl to smoke that weed. Little Marjorie Berry, who at this very moment is lying at death's door. That's why Joan helped me. And I have proof, Your Honor.
Congress passed the Marijuana Tax Act in 1937 and set in motion the following years of marijuana prohibition, which included in 1971 President Nixon's war on drugs that aimed to prevent illegal drug use with longer prison sentences for dealers and users.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive.
The Drug Enforcement Administration's creation in 1973 and President Reagan's Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986, decreeing new mandatory minimum sentences for drugs, including marijuana.
Drugs are menacing our society. They're threatening our values and undercutting our institutions. They're killing our children. From the beginning of our administration, we've taken strong steps to do something about this horror. Tonight, I can report to you that we've made much progress. 37 federal agencies are working together in a vigorous national effort. And by next year, our spending for drug law enforcement will have more than tripled from its 1981 levels. We have increased seizures of illegal drugs. Shortages of marijuana are now being reported. Last year alone, over 10,000 drug criminals were convicted, and nearly $250 million of their assets were seized by the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. And in the most important area, individual use, we see progress. In 4 years, the number of high school seniors using marijuana on a daily basis has dropped from 1 in 14 to 1 in 20.
After 1937, marijuana propaganda persisted for decades. And while the general public's attitude towards marijuana use had significantly changed over the ensuing years since 1937, the propaganda seemed to have had its effect. And the fear instilled in many citizens regarding marijuana and those criminals who sold it was still very much alive in the mid-1980s. The Thunder Bay Police investigation of Scott Dove's murder culminated in the halted coroner's inquest in early 1986. And their only seeming conclusion? That Gary Lamont had previously sold marijuana to Scott Dove, was going to sell him marijuana on Halloween, and Lamont, for some unknown reason, murdered Scott Dove. If in this case police thought the marijuana dealing led to murder, then who was Gary Lamont getting his marijuana from? Police soon determined it was Patrick Hagar. In October 1984, Pat Hagar was already involved with the Satan's Choice Motorcycle Club, becoming a full patch member in 1985 and eventually a Hell's Angel in 2000. Satan's Choice Motorcycle Club was a Canadian outlaw motorcycle club that was once the dominant outlaw organization in Ontario, with 12 chapters based in the province and another in Montreal, Quebec, at its peak strength in 1977. Satan's Choice grew to more than 400 members by 1970, making it the second largest outlaw motorcycle club in the world, behind only the Hells Angels. In 1975, the Satan's Choice began an alliance with the Outlaws Motorcycle Club as their power began to diminish during the late 70s, with some of the club's chapters patching over to the Outlaws in 1977. By 1984, the Satan's Choice had chapters in just four cities in Ontario: Kitchener, Oshawa, Toronto, and Thunder Bay. The remaining chapters would eventually become members of the Hells Angels, along with most of the other major outlaw clubs in Ontario in 2000. I spoke with Pat Hagar.
So Pat, tell me about your membership first in Satan's Choice and the Hells Angels.
Well, I was in the Satan's Choice for 15 years. I guess I hung around with the club about possibly 10 years before I actually joined the club, getting familiar with the club and the guys and traveling around, meeting people, and big waste of time. Well, I had a lot of fun, though. A lot of motorcycle rides and a lot of late night parties, a lot of strippers, a lot of fun. And, you know, you kind of don't think about when it's happening, but a lot of violence, you know, punching guys out all the time. I don't know. Seemed like it was almost too good to be true. You were somebody, you know, because you had the patch on your back. People respected you, feared you. You always had about, a couple hundred guys that would back you up, you know. If you had to, you know, go that way, if you needed people, they were always seen to be there, and they're all willing to do violence at any time. I don't know. I enjoyed it. But, at the end of it all, it didn't really seem like it was really worth it. But, when you're doing it, it seems worth it. You're making money illegally. You're traveling all over the place. You're living on your motorcycle. But, like, there's a price to pay for everything. You're doing time in jail. You're going to prison. You're getting pulled over 3 times a day on your motorcycle. It takes about half an hour to 45 minutes for all the past arrests. And, every caution they have in the world against you to come back on that radio. And, it's happening all the time. A lot of interacting with police. Like, I don't even remember how many times I've been charged with assaulting police. More than I can remember. And it's always, the cops beating you up and charging you with assault. But, when you first put the patch on, that you're going to be going to prison sooner or later. It's just kind of part of the deal. And, there's a lot of people in that, those clubs and that you can't trust. But you don't realize that, because they're all rah-rah behind you. But it's kind of a real, like, a lot of people that are two-faced, would talk behind your back, try to get you in trouble. You know, it's not really a brotherhood like it's supposed to be. It's a lot of greedy bastards trying to fuck each other out of money, and a lot of untrustworthy stuff. Like, I found when I was in the Hell's Angels or the Satan's Choice, like, the Satan's Choice was more of a brotherhood, but the Hell's Angels, you didn't have to worry about any of the other clubs. You had to worry about your own guys. Most guys probably in the Hell's Angels probably get murdered by their own members. For some greedy financial reason or otherwise, or just, who knows why. But there's a lot of history of it.
Let's go back and let's talk about your relationship with Gary Lamont. First off, your relationship with Danny Ranta. Who did you meet first? And the particulars of their relationship, their business relationship, how you first met Danny Ranta and under what circumstances. And tell us about the business that you guys were all involved in.
It was marijuana business. Like I said, I used to have a house on Pearl Street. I used to sell pot out of that address. And Danny Ranta, he was a real younger, I'd even say preteen. And he'd show up there with all this cash and buy pot. And I guess him and Gary were partners in this. And Gary would buy a lot of pot too, like, thousands of dollars worth. And he would sell it and have people selling it for him. And he always seemed to have a little entourage of natives. Because he was from Beardmore. He didn't look nothing like a native, but somehow he associated himself to the natives, and he did have a lot of younger native friends, which seemed kind of weird at the time. But he also had a wife, and, he played like a straight guy. Like, he didn't play like he was gay or anything like that. But I guess later on in his life, he was convicted.
Let's go back to where, before 1984, and the relationship you had in terms of selling marijuana to Gary Lamont and Danny Ranta. Explain that relationship. Gary Lamont sat at a house, but what was Danny Ranta's role?
Well, they seemed just like they were friends and also business partners. But Gary, like, he had epilepsy, and he used to have fits and everything. And when he got excited and that, and to me, that's what would make me think that he wasn't capable of a lot of the stuff that he was capable of. You know what I mean? Because he was being epileptic and he had pancreatitis and he was always sick and he wasn't always real healthy. And then that epilepsy, I don't know, it's to me, it like seemed like if he got excited, he'd have a fit. So to me, I didn't really think that he could be capable.
1984, Gary Lamond is selling weed to high school students at Lakeview, and he's got a place that's close to Lakeview. Danny Ranta is partners with Gary Lamont, but what does that mean in terms of selling marijuana? And where would Danny Ranta sell his marijuana? Where would Danny Ranta sell his marijuana?
Mostly to all his friends, like high school. You know, he seemed to have a lot of people that, you know, because of that age group that wanted to buy it, but mostly in North End, Port Arthur, and, you know, quite possibly a little bit of rural Finlander customers. And he was just out there. He had a house in Current River, and then he eventually he sold out of there, and then he pretty well was like a candy man for Current River for a little while.
Is that, what year was that?
It was after 1984 when he bought that house, probably about 87.
Well, how about 84?
84, he probably still living with his parents.
Right.
And then Gary always had a house and a wife and, you know, sold dope out of there and had a lot of people coming through.
So in 1984, he lived on Fitzgerald and that was a house?
Yeah, yeah. That was a house, plus they rented rooms to students and they had Yogi living in the basement. He was about a 400-pound guy that he'd come up from the basement and sell you the weed.
Right.
He was like, I don't know. He was I think he ended up, eventually died, but he was a real big guy, but he was real smart. Like, he was an accountant, but he also was a friend of Gary's and sold weed for Gary and lived in the basement. But, you know, they'd have a full house of people all the time.
So how were Danny Ranta and Gary Lamont partners?
Well, it was more like, you know, they both sell weed. They put their money together. You know, they'd buy together. Mostly Gary was like the boss and Danny was like the junior partner. And they just seemed to hang around a lot. And, you know, they were always, you know, putting money together to get weed.
Right, right. And was Danny Ranta in high school at that time? Or
he had started out, he was in high school.
Well, do you know in 1984 if he was still in high school?
Well, guaranteed.
And how old do you think he was, 17?
Yeah, something like that, in his teens.
Gary Lamont was full-time. He would open when, in the morning?
Yeah, when people got there.
So he was open.
Yeah.
And Danny Ranta lived at home with his parents, so he would sell maybe at high school.
Yeah, he'd be out and about in the community selling weed, you know. And, you know, he was hanging around Gary's quite a bit, too. You know, people would come there looking for him.
Oh, they could connect with Danny through Gary.
Yeah, they were always together quite a bit.
Right.
You know? So, yeah.
After 1984 and Scott Dove, you say that you told me that you had nicknames for these guys after that.
Yeah, we call them the killers because the police were trying so hard to stick it on Gary that he killed Scott Dove, that just for as a nickname, we'd call Gary the old killer and we'd call Danny Ranta the young killer. So these are just nicknames me and my buddies made up because, you know, like, we didn't know that he killed anybody or anything, but, you know, he just ended up getting the nickname because the cops were, you know, trying to hang that murder on him so much for so long.
But, well, you thought it was really unlikely, and that's why you thought, well, we'll give him these nicknames.
Personally, I thought it was unlikely, but since then, you know, he probably did have a hand in the murder, you know. At the time, I didn't think the guy was really capable of violence, but, you know, somebody that's not capable of violence can always get somebody else to do it for them, you know, especially if they got money or a little bit of influence and stuff like that.
Well, when we're talking about that, then you don't have to name names, but what did you hear was the fate of Scott Dove and why?
Well, you heard that Gary gave that Scott Dove up to two other guys to take them and do whatever they wanted to them. And, you know, I guess I don't know the particulars, but that's all I heard.
And do what with them? You said that these guys were notorious for what? And so what?
Well, one guy stabbed one of my friends, and the other guy was a crazy fucking drug ripoff. Fuckhead, hard language. They're both two really unsavory characters. I don't want to name any names, but I don't have any proof or any. It's just kind of something I heard through the grapevine. And the guy that told me said it was like pretty well general knowledge that this happened. So who knows? Anything's possible.
So the motive was that he was resisting a sexual advance by Gary Lamont?
Possibly, or they were putting it on him that he was a police rat or an informant or something. You know, I don't know why exactly the kid got it or whatever, but this is just what I heard, you know, through the grapevine from another guy that seemed to be closer to those people and that knew them better. And that's basically what he said.
You talk about that he had so much heat. You talked about him at the courthouse. How long are we talking that you understand that he has got a lot of heat on him for the Scott Dove murder? How long do you think that takes after?
I don't know. I'd say up to about 5 years. They were bugging him, doing everything they could to pretty well hang that murder on him. Also raiding his house all the time. And
what were they doing to pin it on him? Give me an example of what they were
doing. Well, it's just like, okay, the word was that Scott Dove left his house with $1,000 to go to Gary's house, and that was the last time he was heard from, okay? So that rumor just caused the police to just make the guy's life miserable. Like, he ended up in jail over it a couple of times and stuff like this, and they really did try to, you know, he's a number one suspect, and they really did try to make a case against him, which they never did, but it's still kind of a mystery of what really did happen, so... I don't know, about 5 years, I'd say. They made his life hell over that murder.
Wow. And what would he say to you about this hassle by the police?
Well, he always denied everything. He said, no, he didn't, you know, he was not involved, and he denied, you know, that he had anything to do with it. And, you know, just knowing the guy, I believed him, because he seemed sincere, and I knew the guy not to be other than what he appeared to be, was, you know, kind of a pacifist, and... you know, I didn't know him to be violent. Like, I never knew him to get into any fights.
Was he a big guy?
Yeah, he was fair size.
Yeah?
Yeah. At one time, I don't know how big he is now, but...
And he was a few years older than the kids, eh?
Yeah, he was always older, yeah. He was in, like, kind of in between younger than me and then older than all these kids. The kids were all, like, teenagers.
When did you first ever speak to police about their suspicions about your involvement with Scott, though? When was the very first time? And you had spoken about it before. Can you remember sort of the kind of gist of the conversation when they did come and they did ask?
Well, I just explained. They asked me questions just like you're interviewing me down at the police station. And I told them, hey, I used to sell Gary weed. And I think I was even a suspect, you know, the way they were treating me and stuff. But and I think that was coming from Gary and his wife, because his wife cleans houses, right? And she was cleaning a friend of mine's house, and she told them that I killed Scott Dove. And then after that, I get all this police attention, like, you know, they were here 4 or 5 times asking me questions, taking me down to the police station for his interview and all that. And I'm pretty sure that came from them people.
They knew where Gary Lamont got his marijuana from.
Yeah, it was in the Satan's Choice, so that kind of would throw kind of a blanket over it. It was choice dope, and you know, people used it after you're alone. If they, you know, we were like not semi possibly protected by the club, but you know, people didn't fuck with you anyway.
Well, I don't think people will understand that. What people may have thought, and what I believe from what people have told me, is that Gary Lamont, after 1984, used the association between you to imply or insinuate or imply that he was somehow involved with the Satan's Choice.
Yeah, I'm guaranteed. He bought a motorcycle, you know, he had tattoos, he tried to look the biker look, he wore support clothes, you know, that anybody could buy. Yeah, sure, of course. You know, play it up as much as he could. Like, I wasn't the only guy in the Satan's Choice that sold him dope either. So there was other guys, you know, they possibly, you know, whatever. He could play the role, you know, because of them too.
I didn't know that. But in 1984, what were you selling specifically to Gary Lamont, as far as you could remember?
Pounds of marijuana.
marijuana?
Yeah, come from BC.
Hollywood and Halloween 1984, marijuana?
Oh yeah, guaranteed.
What else would Gary possibly be selling,
you know,
other than that?
I don't think anything else, really, to tell you the truth. Like, him and Ranta were into coke, but they were mostly into it just for personal use. And as far as I knew, he'd just sell either smokables like marijuana, hashish. You know, I don't even know if he ever got into the honey oil or any of that, but just smokables, basically.
Tell us more about what happens eventually with you and marijuana and convictions.
Oh, I got busted for 138 pounds of Thai weed, a couple of kilos of black hash, and a whole bunkable of automatic weapons. And I end up getting a sentence of 3 years in prison, Stony Mountain. Well, that was one of my beefs. But, you know, I went to court a lot and went to jail a bit, you know, off and on for about probably 30 years.
What was your sentence for the 130 pounds and what happened with those gun charges?
Well, okay, the thing is, my girlfriend was involved. The guns and the marijuana was in the trunk of her car in her name, and the guns were in her apartment, right? So what happened was, we went to court for about 3 years, and then they basically gave us a deal. She could go to jail for 18 months if she accepted that was her guns and marijuana, or I could take 3 years. I'd have to take the blame and she'd walk. So I took the blame, she walked, I got 3 years in Stony, and they dropped the gun charges. So to this day, I still don't have any violence on my record, but I got marijuana, what's the charge? Trafficking illicit substance or something like that. But anyway, I got 3 years for basically 138 pounds of marijuana.
And what year was that?
1992.
How much time did you do, actually?
I did a year.
Yeah.
2 years on parole. You know, which is a big deal. Like, now it's legal. Back then, very few people got busted for that much dope. And, you know, it was kind of a, you know, at the time, it was like a groundbreaking. After that, a lot more people were coming to get busted for a lot more dope. But up until that time, it was a pretty big bust for the cops in Thunder Bay.
Now, can you tell us what Burge told you? And again, he told me as well, but can you tell the story again of what the police did in with their interaction with Burge, your friend Burge?
I don't know. I guess they were asking some questions out there about certain guys. One of the guys stabbed Burge, and, you know, he possibly could have been some kind of suspect. So they went all the way to BC and went to Burge's house in Surrey, British Columbia, and they interviewed him and asked him questions about this one guy that stabbed him before, and he was possibly a suspect, and that's pretty well the long and short of it there.
Did they ask him about anything involving Scott Dove at all?
Well, not really. They were more like asking him about this one guy that maybe they thought that he had something to do with it. I don't know. Burge didn't know Scott Dove. He didn't know anything about it, even living in Vancouver. You know, he may have heard about the murder or not. I don't know. But they were more interested in this other person that had stabbed Burge before. And, you know, he had a kind of a criminal history of violence.
Well, you heard the same name. You heard the same name of the same person.
In the rumor.
In a rumor. And, yeah,
maybe that came around to the police. So.
And the police just happened to have that same name.
Yeah.
In questioning a Verge. What did they ask you about Danny Ranta?
Just about, you know, his relationship with Gary, and did he buy weed off me? And that was, you know, how long I knew him, you know, where I knew him from, stuff like that. That's about it.
So in the questioning of you about, you sold marijuana to Danny Ranta, you sold marijuana to Gary Vermont.
And they were trying to beat around the bush, saying, well, what would happen if somebody pulled a big ripoff, like more or less if Scott Doves pulled a ripoff and that's why he was killed and stuff like this. And I said, well, basically nothing. You know, like, people rip people off all the time in Thunder Bay. And, you know, the worst thing I've ever seen is a guy might get a shot in the head for it or something. You know, it seems inconceivable to me for, you know, somebody to murder somebody over a fucking dope ripoff in Thunder Bay.
So they mentioned dope ripoff. They'd never ever mentioned.
Yeah. They mentioned that. Like, as if, you know, to push it in direction of maybe Scott Dove ripped off possibly me or somebody else. And maybe that's why he got murdered. But, to me, that's inconceivable.
Was Gary Lamont or Danny Ranta in the practice of fronting marijuana to high school students and racking up a huge debt?
Not really. Everything was pretty well cash business. You know, I mean, you know.
There'd be no motive. Would there be any motivation to front him enough large amount so that he could get over his head?
I don't think so.
According to the witnesses at the inquest, he'd been selling marijuana for possibly a full 60 days.
Yeah, probably.
That's it. And selling grams as far as anybody, any testimony. So is it even possible for you or Gary or Danny Ranta to have had any motive to give this guy enough money that he would be in any kind of serious debt?
No, there's no possible way. And even if you are, like, I've had people owe me money. You know, I do now thousands and thousands of dollars. And the only thing that really happens is I don't talk to them and they don't talk to me, you know? That's basically the way things go. Like, I don't think it had anything to do with anything like that, you know? Just, the dope business is like the retail business. You lose so much on bad credit.
Right.
And that's how it goes. You just go on ahead and make more money.
Your membership in the Satan's Choice, did you sell marijuana to Gary Lamont and Danny Ranta, or did the Satan's Choice sell?
Well, I did personally. Yeah, the Choice had nothing to do with it. But it's just that I was a member. And, like, the Choice never got no money out of it or nothing, you know, so that makes it so it was just between me and them. But, you know, usually when you're in something like that, people, they treat you with more respect, you know, as far as the drug world. Because, you know, you probably have, you know, some guys behind you that... possibly could back you up.
What was the rumor you heard in terms of the condition of Scott's body? Did you hear anything?
Well, you know, I've heard everything like that. The kid had his tongue cut out, his privates cut off, put in his mouth, all this crazy, bullshit through the community. But nobody like really knows for sure. I think people just make stuff up, or, you know, they jump at assuming stuff.
If somebody were to want to buy marijuana, ounces of marijuana, a quarter pound of marijuana, and he knew Gary Lamont, but he also knew Danny Ranta. He may have known Danny Ranta longer, I'm not sure. But regardless, he knew Danny Ranta and he knew Gary Lamont. That's according to Danny Ranta. Is there any reason Scott Dove, despite buying ounces of marijuana, according to witnesses from Gary Lamont, is there any reason Scott Dove, not knowing him, but is there any reason for Scott Dove to not be able to buy that same marijuana from Danny Ranta?
Possibly. He could buy the same marijuana from me if he knew me, but he didn't know me, so he'd have to go down the line. So, like, Gary, Danny, you know, they sold kind of... smaller quantities at the door. He could have got off either one of them, for sure.
Gary sold what amount?
He'd sell grams, anything, any amount, from grams to pounds, basically.
Well, what about Danny?
Pretty well the same.
So they both had access to any amount? Or
yeah, 10 pounds at a time.
So if Scott Dove wanted to make a drug deal, wanted to buy some marijuana, he could have arranged a marijuana deal in the morning. Would Gary Lamont do a drug deal outside of his house?
The guy's so hungry for money, he fucking probably do anything. You know, like, they used to sell dope there 24/7, and he'd go there basically any time and somebody would answer the door.
Would it be typical for him to be not there, though? Would he leave the house
himself? He always had, like, subordinates that, you know, answered the door, sold the weed. He'd yell for them, whatever. He'd sit around like he was a king or something.
Have you ever spoke to Danny Ranta about the Scott Dove thing at all, even after my involvement or the interviews or...
Yeah, he's never admitted anything. He always, said he was being accused and he didn't know anything. And,
That's what he has always, you know, portrayed to me.
How was he being accused? Did he ever expand?
I've probably been bucking around questioning him over the years. And, you know, he was pretty tight with Gary at the time when Gary was getting all the flack. So he probably felt some of it.
When did you find out that he was raped by Gary Lamont?
Well, pretty well when he was here one night when he was all drunk. He let it slip or whatever. No. But Gary took advantage of him, raped him, and whatever. But, you know, he was almost like tears in his eyes and stuff like that, you know.
Did he kind of state when that kind of was? What do you know if that was after 1984?
He was just a young teenager.
So you mean before 84 or after 84?
Actually, before 84.
Before 84. And so despite being sexually assaulted, he still...
Yeah.
Was his friend.
Yeah, they still hung out, did business and everything. I don't know. Who knows? Maybe he forgave him. Maybe he liked it. I don't know.
Strange, isn't it?
Well, for me, it would be. For you, it would be. But to these creeps, who fucking knows? You know, like they had some kind of almost like a paternalistic relationship. You know, he was the boss and Danny was a kid. And the guy was twice his age.
Why do you think that Scott Dove was killed?
You know, it just doesn't make sense. Kid's probably just a nice, innocent little kid in the place, wrong place at the wrong time. That's probably what happened there. Anyway.
Yeah.
But not knowing anything about it, all I can do is just knowing Gary and the rest of the situation, he probably had something to do with it. That's pretty basically all I really have to say.
Join me next time for part 3 of The Assassins of Youth on True Murder, The Most Shocking Killers, wherever you get your podcasts.